So, Piero, you are the CEO of Predibase, and you're also someone who has explored machine learning and NLP in various roles and engagements. Can you maybe start off by telling us a few interesting facts about machine learning? You know, maybe a couple that our audience will enjoy hearing about.
Sure. I would say in my experience, I've been working on many different projects. For instance, when I was at Uber, I worked on customer support models. I worked on recommender systems for Uber Eats. I worked on fraud detection, and I worked on the dialogue system for Uber drivers. And I would say the interesting thing that I gathered from all these projects is the fact that what is common, there's a lot that is in common among all these projects and all these tasks. And what is not in common in many cases is relatively limited. And it is boils down to the data schema that you're training on. But the techniques across all of these different tasks are basically almost all the same right now. And so my ethos has been to try to find what is common among them and what is different, and making what is different easy to change and what is common solid to build on, right? That is definitely one thing that I discovered that I find interesting, right?
Do you think it's a good thing, though, if there are extensive commonalities between certain components? Like, how do you strive for differentiation then if there are so many commonalities in maybe the applications or the use cases that you highlighted?
Yeah, so I would say the differentiation comes from the, let's say, inventiveness, if you want, of the person developing the project that understands the domain. And by understanding the domain, they can change the data, can change the data schema, can change, for instance, the features that are used within the models. But in the end, the training loop, for instance, the exact implementation of the models, making them train fast in a distributed way, making them efficient in inference, all these things can be done once and in the best way possible. People don't need to reinvent the wheel every single time on those. But the wheel, the part of the process that is bespoke for each single project, is the part that is the domain part that is more interesting and fun, honestly.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine. You've mentioned the word data schema a couple of times now. What is that, just to people that are not familiar with that component of terminology?
Yeah, usually, I mean, it may vary a bit depending on machine learning tasks, but in the end, it boils down to providing data in a format that is kind of standardized. And well, there are exceptions, but the vast majority of machine learning tasks, in the end, the data is structured as a table where you have like all examples as rows of that table, and all the columns of that table are features of those examples, characteristics that help, you know, identify or perform the task, right? And usually for each row, there's also like the specific output that you want the model to be trained to produce. And so that schema of that table is actually the schema that you end up providing to the model when you are training it. And then it's also the schema of the data when you query the model that you need to provide to be able to obtain new predictions, right?
Excellent. So hi, everyone. It's Lauren Hawker-Zaffer. Welcome back to Redefining AI, the tech podcast. Today, I've been joined by Piero Molino, the CEO and co-founder of Predibase, a low-code AI platform. So Piero, Ludwig, the name says something to you, does not? Who or what is Ludwig?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it connects really well with the previous question. It is the open source declarative machine learning project that I created when I was working at Uber. And now it's, you know, a project that is backed by the Linux Foundation, so has a proper open source governance. And it's also the project that is at the foundation of the technology of what we are building at Predibase. And it actually encapsulates what we were discussing, the commonalities and the bespokeness of different machine learning projects. Because actually the way it works is exactly by providing a mechanism for users to define the machine learning models and pipelines through a configuration file. And so all the parts that I was mentioning, like the training, the inference, the evaluation, are all hard-coded in the system, which is actually really easy to extend, but they're all hard-coded. And the configuration file just contains the information about the data. For instance, you can specify many different inputs for your machine learning model, outputs of what you want the model to predict, the data type associated with them, like if it's a piece of text, it's like a column of categories, or it's an image or whatever. And that configuration is substantially easier and faster to write than the low-level machine learning code, but achieves the same performance and the same goals much faster and with less effort.
Okay. And you spoke about the, it has specific open source project governance. Is that correct? What does that encompass when we're talking about like open source project governance?
Yeah. So the project started as, you know, when I was working at Uber, right? So it was owned by Uber as a project. And the problem with, in particular, large organizations, but almost, you know, every organization that is not a foundation, like the Linux Foundation, for instance, when governing like a project like that, is that users never know what is going to happen to the project. They have no guarantees, right? And things that could happen is that at a certain moment in time, the license of the project changes. Mm. And if I'm a contributor, I want to know that I'm contributing to a project that will keep being open. Otherwise, I will be basically working for Uber or whoever is the owner of that project for free if they then close it and take advantage of my work, my previous work, right? And so that's part of the reason why we donated it to Linux Foundation, because the Linux Foundation is kind of like a guarantee that the project will always keep being open, because there is a governance of the project that is set by the foundation. And that's, you know that the project is not going to change license. Recently, there have been a couple of companies that have actually explicitly done that. Like there was HashiCorp, for instance, most recently, and also Hugging Face, that took some of their projects and change the license of this project into something that is not fully open source. And that's avoidable by, you know, having an open governance.
Is it always then a commercial or capital motivation that drives someone to change a project from keeping it open to actually making it closed source? Or are there other reasons as well?
So, yeah, mostly there are commercial reasons and, you know, I would say in many cases, preventing other companies from being able to commercialize the open source project that that company put out is the main reason. There have been examples in the past, like for instance, Elasticsearch. Amazon created like their own fork of Elasticsearch and started to sell it without, you know, contributing back to the open source project, which is not a great practice. But on the other hand, if the open owners of the open source project, creators of the open source project, apply the same tactic, you know, then it becomes like open source is not open anymore, right?
So. Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, if we look at from an interaction perspective of the provider that's obviously providing the open source environment and the user that's interacting with that environment, and we're looking more sort of holistically at the universal approach to democratization through open source, how does it benefit users then? From what perspective are they benefiting? Is it the option to access technologies like that for free? What are the actual sort of potential avenues of positive enhancement for the user?
So my experience with it has been that there's different types of users, if you want, find different kind of value. For instance, I consider myself also a user of Ludwig and the open source, right? So for my perspective of creating the project, my main intent was to honestly, to give back to the community, because my project initially was like an Uber internal project, right? And it was using and importing many other open source projects to begin with. And so it felt for me, honestly, like, you know, a little bit of an ethical thing to do to begin with, right? Mm. On the other hand, I was one person developing this project, right? So putting it out there was a forcing function for me for increasing the quality of it, and also for receiving feedback and being able to improve, and also receiving some help, because, you know, now there's a community around it and I'm not the one, you know, doing all the PRs and all the changes and all of that. There's like a bunch of people who are doing that and improving the project, right? From a, you know, more user perspective, I would say there's one advantage is obviously you have access to potentially, you know, good technologies for free, and you can do with it whatever you want. But more than that, if you encounter an issue or an error or something that gets in the way of you using it, if it was closed source, you had nothing that you could do other than going to the, you know, software provider and asking them for the change and wait for whatever time they had and their prioritization. But if you're a user of open source, you can go there and change whatever, make the fix that unlocks you, right? So that's an empowering aspect. And I would say the very final aspect, which is super important though, is the community aspect, right? So people that have the same interest in using this project collaborate between each other, ask questions to each other, and the larger the community, the more likely that someone can find an answer and can find someone who can help them out, right? So there's that participatory aspect that is very, very important.
Yeah, which is really interesting, because then you almost question if there can be some sort of metric that would measure the quality of the software development dependent on the closeness or the openness. Like, can you make a statement? And I'm not saying that you can, I'm sort of questioning, like, can you make a statement and say that one could hypothesize and maybe sort of speculate that open source software is more regulated than closed source software? Do you feel that also the sort of psychological pressure of being part of a community and having that accountability and transparency contributes to that, or is none of that true?
I'm really convinced of that, honestly. You know, there is this famous book called The Cathedral and the Bazaar that really, you know, highlights this kind of more collaborative projects as, you know, the bazaar approach as opposed to the cathedral top down. You can also rephrase it to be top down versus bottom up to a certain extent, right? And one of the really good examples there is Wikipedia, that is like self-regulated, but in the end, it would be really difficult to achieve that kind of average level of quality and that breadth of coverage if it was not community collaborative project. That is what makes it possible for it to exist to begin with. It would be too complex for an organization, even a large one, to do on their own. And the top-down kind of decision-making could impact the quality negatively, right? And that book makes an argument for the bazaar to be like a better alternative to the cathedral in most situations. So, and I, you know, subscribe to it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting analogy that you painted there as well. So if we look at machine learning and model building per se, it's, as we mentioned at the start, something that you have great expertise in. I think that you mentioned to me previously in our briefing that there's been this shift in the process of accessing and utilizing machine learning models, where data collection and labeling are sort of no longer the initial steps. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that and talk about the change and maybe its the sort of implications on democratization of AI, etc.?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a topic that I'm, you know, spending a lot of time thinking these days, because obviously impacts also us as a company, right? And so because of that, it's like really top of mind for me. The way I see it is, you know, there have been large language models for a while now, but they only gained steam starting last November with the release of ChatGPT, right? So I think it was more a matter of interface than technology, because what was going on behind the scenes behind ChatGPT were the same exact models that were available, like GPT-3.5 Turbo, that was available for a while before, right? But not nobody, but a substantially smaller amount of people were paying attention to it than the ones that got hooked by interacting with ChatGPT, right? And so that revealed to many people the fact that there are tasks, in particular some natural language-based tasks, where a general model can perform really well without the need to provide it additional data. A really good example of that is, for instance, summarization, right? If you try to use such ChatGPT, point it to like some piece of text, provide it in the prompt and tell it to summarize it, you get a really competent summary, right? And you have done nothing, meaning you have not really trained any model, right? It was already there available for you to query and get the results out, right? So for the machine learning development process, you know, you always kind of start it from data collection. And when you want to train a model, you know, starting point of training that model is having the data that is collected. But the goal of training that model is that then you want to run inference on it to new data points. But if there's a general model that is already available that you can run already inference on, why do you want to train at all to begin with, right? And so these questions led me to think about how the machine learning process is redefined by the access to large language models and large pre-trained models in general, right? So my current thinking, which is still in flux, but is like my current conclusion, I would say, but a year from now, maybe we can have again this conversation and my answer could be different. It's actually really a positive change because it makes the power of these technologies available much earlier, right? And so the beginning of the process is not anymore collect the data, is start to query a model and see if the model can already produce the outputs that you want. The reality, though, is that for many, many tasks, the trade-off between the quality that you could get and the cost of running these large general models is not ideal. In particular, you can have these large general models that produce anything, for instance, French poetry, but maybe you want to use them for just the task of summarizing tweets or categorizing reviews of items in a recommender system or things like that, right? And so over time, if you build an application using a general model, over time you will collect data. And the data then can be used for training a smaller, specific, not general, model that achieves the same, if not higher performance than the general model on that specific task, and it's cheaper and faster to serve. But the discovery phase, if it's worth doing it or not, or if it's feasible at all, doesn't start with data anymore, but starts from like querying the model.
Yeah, exactly. And that was actually going to be my question, because I was thinking about the likelihood of it actually, so the LLM, the large language model, of it producing the specific data that you want. Because obviously there's a lot of, given the fact that the majority of them are trained on the World Wide Web, then the specificity of data that certain enterprises require or want and also need, dependent on obviously the gated component of content that would want to be accessed. I think that there is that necessity for what you've just outlined, that you've got smaller models that are obviously much higher performing.
I completely agree with that. And I think it's like, it combines a bunch of things, combines specificity with performance, because again, the fact that it's specific is what enables it to perform really well on, you know, on user data, despite the fact of being smaller, right? And that makes it for like a cheaper model to serve because it's smaller, and so also faster kind of latency and inference speed. So the combination of all these aspects makes it for something that is production grade, as opposed to a general model that, you know, may be doing its job well in the general case, but it's also potentially pretty slow. Like if you have streaming data, 10,000 data points a second, but running inference takes half a second for each of these data points, obviously these two numbers don't really work together really well, right? So,
and I mean, I think that regardless of the either or, depending on what model you choose to use, there's always that impertinent concern and crucial concern of data security, especially when using machine learning models in an enterprise setting. How do you address the issue of data security while enabling more people, like including developers, to access and use machine learning models, especially like generic larger ones that are built for end consumption?
Yeah, so our approach, which may not be the only one, but our approach is to, first of all, we decided that we want to provide to our customers only open source models. And the rationale behind it is that, you know, they are, users can inspect them and can analyze them, and the whole community can provide evaluations and not really guarantees, but, you know, the fact that all eyes are on them from the whole community increases the likelihood of having, you know, if there's something wrong or because they generate unconstrained text that is damaging or insulting or whatever, you know, everybody will notice that and will be able to do something about it, right? That's one aspect. And then purely on the data safety, security, and not leaking out data, the way we approach it is that we make it possible for people to deploy these models in their own virtual private clouds. So that, again, the customer data that goes into these models never leave their own environment, and the outputs are never leave their environment, and the models themselves live there, so that there's all full ownership. And so even if you train a model, fine-tune one of the open source models on your data, the artifact that is the output of the new model weights belong to you as a customer, right? We think that it's very, very important. The reason is that otherwise, if all the data in the world is piped to one company, I think there's like a concern with that to begin with. And the other, you know, bigger concern is, how do I as a company protect myself and differentiate myself from others? And data is my asset, right? And so if I give up that asset, I am worse off by giving up that asset. So I don't think that companies will want to give up that asset. And so I think that this kind of approach of isolating the environments is the best one so far.
Yeah, I can imagine it is quite a concern. I mean, have you had any reservations, especially around the approach of offering the model as an open source model? Like, what are sort of typical narratives that you are approached with and that you discuss, just to give for listeners a little bit of an idea about sort of generic concerns that come with providing an open source model, especially to, I imagine, like B2B customers, if you're targeting those? Is it less of a concern for a B2C market? Like, what sort of conversations are you having?
So I see, like, the potential downsides of a model like that that I see are that really you cannot control beyond, again, the specific commercial customers that you have. But again, once you put it in the open source, you cannot fully control the usage of those models, right? And there is a potential concern because, again, there could be a negative externalities from it. People can use them for potentially for harm of different kind, right? On the other hand, I think one could make an argument that is similar to the argument of security. Mm-hmm. And in the security community, is pretty well understood that security by, let's say, obfuscating and obscuring the source code of what you're doing is not a great idea, because then you don't know if there's an exploit, and the exploit can go not caught for a long, long time. While if it's in the open, there's multiple eyes there, and so it's more likely that someone who will have discovered the exploit and is enabled to fix it, right? Which is not true in the closed source case. And so despite the fact that, again, I acknowledge the fact that open source models can potentially be used for harm, I think it's better to have them open so that those harms can be mitigated by the whole community, right? I would rather trust the community to mitigate the harm than a single company to do it.
So, I mean, I think, like, just before we end our conversation, I think it's important to reflect on the possible development now of the machine learning open source ecosystem, and also how that plays into generative AI as a whole. What's your own opinion? What do you foresee? Or maybe your hopes and expectations?
Yeah, I would say there are a few aspects that I think, at least for me personally, are particularly important. I think I'm really enthusiastic about the development of machine learning in the open, in particular because I've seen the speed and the enthusiasm of the community in providing, you know, tools and models that are very, very effective. And if you see, there was that famous leaked document, it was an internal Google document where they were basically telling their own employees that they felt that they had no defensible moat when it comes for LLMs. And their rationale was a slide where they had performance. Don't know exactly how it was calculated, but there was GPT-4, their own internal Bard, and the performance of open source models. And the earlier open source models, like, by earlier, actually, I mean 6 months ago, not so much long ago. Mm-hmm. And the latest, the speed of at which they were improving was so high that they were like, that slide was basically projecting, matching, if not overcoming, the performance of the closed source systems very, very fast, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's one aspect that makes me very excited about it. One concern that I have is explicitly about data and data ownership. Most of these models are trained, honestly, on data that they should not have been trained on. If you look at the Lion dataset in particular, it's a dataset that has been scraped from the internet without permission from the authors of these images. And the models generate image that can imitate the, you know, source material they've been trained on. And that's detrimental to the people that have been produced these images potentially. And I don't find that, you know, really ethical to begin with. It's to be seen if it's legal or not. In different jurisdictions are like moving to identify, creating like new legislature about it. So we will see if it's legal or not. But for me personally, I don't think that that's ethical to begin with, right? So that is a potential issue that I see. But it's true for both closed source and open source. Closed source can also scrape the same data in the same way, right? So.
Yeah, sure. Do you think it's possible, though, to sort of cap or put a net around data ownership and really regulate it, especially when it pertains to a data set as large as scraping the World Wide Web?
I think it's difficult, and I think it's difficult also to have guarantees more than anything else. But for instance, I believe that we should at least start by doing something like having licenses around pieces of content that not only include, can I copy this? Can I share this? Can I do something commercial with it? Like, you know, the Creative Commons licenses. But for instance, Creative Commons licenses could start to include, can I train a model?
Yeah. Which would be an initial and an important step to approach what you're highlighting.
That doesn't guarantee that nobody will ever train a model in it, right? But at least it will give the authors of the content some, you know, a legal mechanism to potentially say, well, listen, this model is generating something that's exactly like my content or something very, very close to my content, probably was trained also on it. So maybe, you know, can require a little bit more clarity and transparency about it.
Yeah, well, it's certainly a fascinating discussion, and it's one that can go in so many different directions. I mean, I think that there's so many ethical and ownership concerns that come into more prominence nowadays as well because of the use of machine learning models in generative AI and obviously the applications that they're being used for. So I want to thank you for being here with us today and obviously sharing your insight and experience with us. It's been great.
Yeah, it was my pleasure, Lauren. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So I'd like to thank everyone else who's stayed with us today, who's listened to the conversation, who's enjoyed the conversation. Don't forget to subscribe to Redefining AI on your favorite podcast channel, and we'll enjoy being with you soon.